Station number 16716, Canon Gervais Markham Reel 5.
Canon Markham, Reel 5. What happened to you next?
Well, at that time I was with the Warwickshire Yeomanry in Palestine, and they had had one campaign in Iraq the previous year, but now they were called up to take part in the Western Desert. So in May 1942, we were put into a train and went from Palestine, across the Sinai Desert, back to Egypt, and were put into a camp just at the foot of the pyramids. And there we waited for further orders. It was at this time that I happened to trip over a guy rope at the entrance to my tent and broke a cartilage in my knee. And had to be taken to hospital. This was an ignominious way of ending my period with the Warwickshire Yeomanry, but while I was in hospital, the colonel came to see me and said, as they were expecting to go up the desert any time, they felt that they had better have a padre who was able to go with them. So I think he was rather glad to have a good excuse for finding a replacement for me, though he never said so. And so that was the end of my period with the Warwickshire Yeomanry. By the time I was able to hobble about, I was able to get round Cairo a bit, obviously pretending that I was a wounded hero, but not being any such thing at all, as I'd not even seen a shot fired in anger in the whole of the war. I stayed in a chaplain's club, which had been set up quite close to the Anglican Cathedral in Cairo. Looking back on it, that was a moment when attending a sort of civilian choir practice in Cairo Cathedral, I sat behind a young lady with dark hair, who in fact later became my wife for 47 years. That was the first time we met. She was in the Rens in Egypt. But anyhow, that was by the way at the time, and as soon as I was better and had sick leave and so on, I was posted to join the 124 Field Regiment Royal Artillery. And this, by this time, it was in September. And I then went up the desert for the first time, and found this regiment was attached, was part of the 50th Division, and had been in action, of course, but had come back with the rest of the British Army to within a few miles of Alexandria, and was there waiting this critical period, wondering whether Rommel was going to penetrate the last few miles to get into Egypt. I eventually found my way to the unit, and they were actually in action at the time. It was the first time I'd actually seen a gun firing ammunition at an enemy target, which was quite an exciting thing for me at the time. Though, of course, they were several miles away and quite out of sight. There was a delightful Colonel Todd, with whom I became great friends, because I stayed with 124 Field Regiment all through the main campaigns till I joined the Dunham Light Infantry in Normandy. But that was much later on. So there I was with 124 Field Regiment, who were in considerable disarray, having been chased up and down the desert for so long. And this was the Battle of Al-Anhalfa, when Rommel made his final attempt to get round the southern flank of the British Army, but was prevented. The real turning point, of course, was not the fact that I had joined 124 Field Regiment, but that Monty had arrived and taken command of the 8th Army. Together, we never looked back after that. he had made an astonishing contribution to the whole life and feeling of the army. His very presence had enlivened everybody. He'd taken complete control. He made himself known to anybody, and within a very few weeks, he'd become a very strong, distinct personality who had revitalized the whole spirit of the army. He made us quite convinced that we were going to fight a battle before very long, when he was ready for it, and not before, that we were going to win, and that he was going to defeat Rommel and push him right back. And during the next few weeks, we were training hard. What we didn't know was, but what Monty knew was, that there were the new Sherman tanks were on their way to the Middle East, coming up the Red Sea, and he was not going to start a battle until they had arrived, until we had trained with them. But the moment did arrive when the Battle of Alamein began on that dramatic night, October the 23rd, when the whole sky was lit up with this tremendous barrage, and for the next 10 days we were all involved in the Battle of Alamein.
Did you come, or had you come under fire yourself at this point? The Germans fired on you?
Oh, well, now, if you are coming under fire, is a thing that is describes many situations. I was not with the infantry. Nobody was ever shooting bullets at me. With a field artillery, you are several miles behind the front line. You are given targets to shoot at the enemy, and they respond with counter battery fire. So they are trying to hit your artillery. So you are under fire from long distance if you're anywhere near the guns. But after a bit, you get used to the fact that you are living under a curtain of shells going in different directions, from your own heavy artillery going over your head one way and the enemy artillery coming back the other way. And though you might say one might drop on you at any moment, yet in fact it doesn't disturb you once you get used to it. You just go on. With being a chaplain to an artillery regiment doesn't expose you to any particular mortal danger from the enemy. You never see an enemy.
Basically, you just had to keep out of the road of all this activity that was going on within the unit.
As a chaplain to the unit, my job was to... I went round the batteries, visiting the batteries wherever they might be. It's always difficult, of course, in modern conditions, because everything is so separated. You can't walk from one place to another. It's too far. You have to get some sort of transport. And at that particular moment, there was no transport for the Padres. To get from one place to another, you had a batman who was carrying your luggage, but you had to find a place in the back of the mess truck or some other vehicle to get you from one place to another. It wasn't until several weeks, perhaps months later, that the assistant chaplain general, Hughes, great man, managed to get jeeps for all the padres so that they could, in fact, go where they needed to go on their own without having to catch a lift with somebody else, which very much hampered your work, of course.
Do you remember your batman? You said you had a batman.
Several batmen, yes. The first one was called Brian, he became a batman driver. Now, in those days, every officer had a batman who was responsible for taking the immediate sort of pressing personal responsibilities off the officer so that he could do his work and look after his men. I know it was a relic of, say, 18th century days when gentlemen had a personal servant, but it was a very necessary thing for an officer who was responsible even for a platoon or for a company or for a battalion. He had got to see that certain thing. He got to see that his men were in the right position, that men were fed, his men were clothed, and men had got billets, or men had got dugouts. And if he was at the same time wondering, have I cleaned my boots? Have I got a, is my bed made up? Where's my next meal coming from? Then he couldn't give his attention to what he was there to do, which to look after his men and to command his men. So with my batman driver, whom I had several, whom I became great friends, they were posted to me. They may not have been part of the regiment to which I was attached, but maybe have got some small disability or maybe whatever it was, but they were regarded as being suitable for him to be a Padre's batman driver. But what in fact he did, when we had our jeep, he drove my jeep, he maintained it, he saw that it had got fuel in and no punctures, the wheels were all right, and he saw to my luggage, my kit, as well as my own personal valise in which I slept. There was my army, my chaplain's kit, my communion set, my box of hymn books and service books. I indeed had a little portable organ at that time, which would fold up, and which, if we were going to have a service, could unfold and stand. It was a box about 3 foot square, and there was usually somebody who would volunteer to play for a hymn. I think it was originally made by the Japanese for missionaries. It was a curious little thing. I also acquired a set of church bells, which I've still got, to give an indication of when and where there was going to be a service. I'd gone to the souk in Jerusalem, and where they make camel bells and sell camel bells. And I had, by the way, in the course of my time in Palestine, I had qualified as an Arabic interpreter. I'd learned a bit of Arabic when I was at this school, but in coming back to Palestine, I thought I'd take this seriously, and I took lessons, and indeed qualified as an interpreter, was posted in Middle East General Orders as interpreter in Arabic, though it was still very limited, of course. But to go back to the souk, I went and found the biggest camel bell that I could find, and I struck it, boom, you see, and then I had to find another one, which was a tone higher, boom, boom. I tap one, and they would say, "Oh, very good bell." Then it was, "What's wrong with this bell?" You see, only had big. I would say, and I didn't know how to say it's the wrong note. I had to get. In the end, I got five, which went boom, 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 boom. And I had these fixed up on a little frame by one of the engineers, and got a brass thing. I could hit this thing and play bells. And I still got it downstairs, and we use it from time to time. That was a sort of peculiarity of chaplain's life in the desert, if you want to record it for posterity.
What was life like in the desert? You're now into the desert itself, yes, aren't you?
Mm. Well, that's been described many times, hasn't it? The desert is not a purely flat thing. It's a mixture of rocky bits and sandy bits and ups and downs and hollows and depressions. The way you find your way about is because you belong to a unit, and each unit has got a sign, and if you're trying to coming up, say, from Cairo to find where your particular unit is in the desert, you first see 8th Army sign by the roadside. No, right, you go further forward, and then you see there's a 50 div sign, the TT sign by the roadside. It's somewhere in my division. And then you follow it along till you get to your brigade sign, and then finally there's your regimental sign, and you know that you've found your place. You have to learn how to find your way about by knowing the signs of the different units that are there. But living in the desert, you get used to the fact that there are a lot of flies. You have to be careful about your latrine procedure of digging a hole somewhere well away and covering it up again. Because if you're on the move, you don't have proper latrines dug. You have to make your own arrangements for that. Your food was brought up to you, and there's a constant swarm of flies around you, so that when you drink your tea, you're flapping your hand with one to flap and drinking your tea with the other to keep the flies off your mug. But these are things incidental to everybody who is recording impressions of the desert, no doubt.
It was a situation, as you say, you got used to it. You came to terms with it.
Oh, yes. Though, as a matter of fact, I got this sort of dysentery after a bit, which I remember I got boils on my face and had to have all sort of bandages over my face, so it looked an awful sight for some time. In fact, I had to be sent back and be treated at one time. It was very ignominious, because to be classed as undesert worthy was a very humiliating thing for any man. But we were all very young and probably very healthy. I was in the 20s. I remember talking to a sergeant who was 40. 40? Man like you out here, you ought to be at home. 40 was an ancient age, it was in those days, to find anybody who was as much as that. You know. Most of them were just lads in their early 20s, all the soldiers. You
know. Where was the unit from? Or was it a North Country unit?
124 Field Regiment, yes, it's based in Newcastle. Yeah, it was very much a local regiment. They all knew each other, they were all Geordies, or were the ones who'd been TA originally. And occasionally there are still reunions in Newcastle, the 124 Field Regiment. It was TA, part of the 50th Division, the TT 50th Northumbrian Division. So that was my first contact with the soldiers from Durham. Yeah.
You say you were then into the Alamein Battle. What are your memories of that battle starting? That particular night, particular time. Must have had a great sense of something great going to happen.
We knew something was going to happen a few days before we were. And the great build up for it. We were told on the day. Friday, October the 23rd, this was, at midday, the colonel had a parade of officers, this is from my diary, and told us that the battle started today. At 10 o'clock, the armoured divisions were to go through the minefields. Our fire, regimental, was due for 9:25 p.m., but we are unlikely to have much to do till Sunday. The men were all told of the great occasion in the afternoon, so on. At sundown, I walked round C Troop, who are in the bottom of the depression, had a word with the men at each gun. Everyone is glad that the battle is due to begin at last. It was a full moon, a gloriously calm, warm night. I walked on to D Troop, who are on the edge of the depression, have a good view all round. All the men were at their guns. Ammunition was being polished. Fred, the GPO, gun position officer, was standing at the command post, watch in hand. Inside, the telephonist was listening to instructions from battery command post. Z minus 35 drew near, i.e. 21, 25 hours. Down the wire came, 5 minutes to go. The lamp on the post from which the guns take their angle went black, the wick having been turned up too high. A man ran across with an electric torch. He had 30 seconds to go, 5 seconds to go. Fire! And as Fred shouted down his megaphone, the whole regiment let go together, and all along the horizon, flash after flash appeared. The air began to crack and rumble as the near and distant guns fired on their tasks. The battle for Africa had begun. That was the beginning of Battle of Alamein, so far as I was concerned.
Mm. Yeah. It was a tremendous personal surge.
Oh, it was, yes, because we knew this was likely to be a turning point of the war, as indeed it was, and proved to be.
Seeing all those shells hurtling into space on such a scale, do you have any thoughts of the poor German or Italian at the other side who's receiving it?
I don't remember feeling any personal sorrow for them. They were just the enemy. You didn't see them, you didn't know them. You knew that they were trying to win the war for a cause which you regarded as an evil cause of Nazism. And so you were glad to be fighting a battle which would help to win the war. There was no opportunity or occasion for sympathizing with the individual soldier who was on the opposite side. Mm-hmm. Even as a chaplain, that was only a very secondary thought.
Mm-hmm. As the battle continued, what happened to you?
We knew that the infantry, which included the double right infantry, of course, were going forward through the minefields, which the sappers had cleared a way through, and were finding their way from one post to another. And I have, in fact, 2 or 3 years ago, heard Ian English describe this battle very vividly with a personal narrative at one of the Dunwright Infantry reunions, a most remarkable thing. That an officer who was so completely in charge of the actual fighting should be able to describe it so vividly 50 years later. But for us, as gunners behindhand, there was, of course, we were being shelled but like everybody else, but there were not many casualties among the gunners. But day by day, we heard of advances here, there, and everywhere, till finally the breakthrough came after 10 days, and suddenly the whole German-Italian line collapsed, and we were able to advance, my first experience anyway, of advancing across a battlefield and seeing a defeated army with all the relics that they'd left behind, and their dugouts still there with the meals half eaten, and Italian troops standing there, waiting to be captured, because the Germans had taken all the transport and had driven away, leaving the Italians to look after themselves without food or water or transport, begging to be taken into captivity. And so there was great excitement on when we finally discovered that the battle had been won. And I had my birthday on November the 7th. I remember having a little sort of birthday party. In the afternoon, I bedded a sapper who'd been shot by a comrade playing with an Italian revolver. Side by side, we bedded an Italian prisoner of war. About 500 of them were standing half a mile away. They had no food or water. We had none to spare for so many. We had no transport to take them away in. They were too tired to walk. Another 1,000 were reported a few miles away, and more to come in. They needed no capturing, etc. In the evening, we had a birthday party. The colonel, the new adjutant, the CO, and two guests for a dinner. Somehow fresh meat had been delivered, and we had first-class steaks with tinned fruit to follow. As a special delicacy to mark my birthday and our victory in the desert, I produced the flask of brandy that I had filled before leaving England and carried about ever since, in case I got into a lifeboat. We each got enough to have a good liqueur at the end of dinner, and it warmed the cockles of our hearts. That was my birthday after the victory of Alamein.
You then become involved in the advance.
Well, then we were through the enemy lines, yes, and but of course we couldn't just go on advancing. It had to be a very controlled thing. Everything, of course, depended upon the supply of petrol and water. And there was only one road for the whole of the army, this one tarmac road which came out from Alexandria and wound along the coast and went all the way across to Tripoli. And this one tarmac road had to carry all the transport of all the army the further we advanced, as we were to do later on.
Mm-hmm. Where did it take you? In the
well, at first, the 50th Division, we were in the hills near Benghazi. We were camping there for some time, over Christmas, in fact, waiting for the next push forward, which was to get the British Army through the El Agheila line, which was the next one, down at the bottom of the Great Bay on the north coast of Africa. And we were not involved in that. So we had to wait in rather bleak conditions over the month of December in what was a rather cold winter for North Africa, waiting for the next stage to go forward. Then describe all this, my journeys to and fro.
You'd move up from there towards what was to become the Marath battle, did you?
That was a good deal further on. In January, we went further forward down to the bay of Regima, that's south of Benghazi, going round the along the coast of North Africa. I had one or two expeditions to places of interest like Cyrene and Derna, and went able to see Tobruk while I was just going fetching a cash, for example, to pay the army. And at last we had our we got transport. Of course, that's right. We were camped in Benghazi because all our trucks were taken away from us, and we couldn't go anywhere because they were needed for something else. But it was only in March that we began to go forward again, and the long trek along the north coast of Africa, till finally we got to Tripoli, which seemed an enormous distance we'd come from Alexandria. But we didn't wait long at Tripoli, because the next battle was due to be fought across the border in Tunisia at the Marath line. And our regiment was involved very much in the Battle of Marath, which was a very serious one, which happened in March the next year, March the 16th and 17th.
What are your memories of that particular action? You'd be supporting the Durham Brigade again, were you?
Our regiment, there was the Durham 151 Brigade. That is the 6th, 8th and 9th battalions of Durham Light Infantry. And we were the regiment of artillery in support of that brigade, yes. I've got a detailed description of what I was doing, which would take quite a long time to read. I see in my diary here it takes many pages, so that I can't describe it to you in detail. But it was the real job was for the infantry, who had to cross this fearful barrier of a great trench, a wadi, which was highly defended. Far as our regiment was concerned, we had an officer who was our forward observation officer, who of course had to go on with the infantry in order, with a signaller, wireless, to signal back to the guns where they had to fire from. So the FOO, one of the subalterns, was he was in the post of danger with the infantry.
Yeah.
And I was, when I heard stories of what was going on, I was very thankful I was not a chaplain with the infantry. That was